Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to a very, very interesting episode in Afternoon Satsang. As always, offering this segment at the lotus feet of our dear Swami, I'm Arvind from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Prem. And we have picked a topic which could be called something like a burning issue, if we can say so, because in the past few months, there have been several occasions where this question has been asked. And this question is something that has been going on within our own selves, and I'm sure that everyone at some point or the other in their life would have come across this question, because it is so wide and it is so global in its implications. Now, you know, Prem, I remember when I was a kid and we were traveling from Bangalore to Mysore. There are two cities in the state of Karnataka of the country India. The distance is about 120 kilometers and it would take about 4 hours by bus. And as a child, I would sit on one side of my mother and my sister on the other side. It would often be a three-seater and a triple seat in the bus, and therefore we would sit by turns at the window.
Okay.
So my mother in the center and both of us on either side of her. And one of the things that we would immediately start doing, say within 10-15 minutes of the journey starting, would be, "Mom, has Mysore come? Mom, has Mysore come? When will we come to Mysore?" The journey had hardly begun and already we would be keen to know when it would end and how would the completion be, how far it is. And she would tell us in ways we would understand. She will show us the watch and say that, "Now see, this hand is over here.
Mm-hmm.
When this hand comes over here, we will be in Mysore. And that would be 2 hours. And the next, what I would do is, instead of tracking the distance and asking when will Mysore come, I will tell Mom, "Show me your hand," and have a look at her watch to see where that little hand is moving. And I would curse and fret and fume and wonder why it is not moving faster, when it would move to that spot. You know, it almost seemed magical that that little hand moves to that spot and you come to Mysore. Things have changed. Things have changed as you grow up, you know. As you grow up, things definitely change. But even to this day, there is something that has not changed. For instance, recently when I was driving from Bangalore to Puttaparthi, of course, my mother was in the car and I wasn't asking her how far away is Puttaparthi and when will we reach Puttaparthi, and she didn't have to show her watch. But all the while, you know, I would keep checking on the milestones which said Puttaparthi 80 kilometers, Puttaparthi 50 kilometers. And then because it's a wonderful Asian highway, the AH-43, brilliant, what connects Bangalore to Puttaparthi. It goes on. At Kodur we have to take a detour. But for most part of the journey, it's the Asian Highway 43. It's a brilliant road and you can constantly keep driving at something like 80 to 90 kilometers per hour. So it becomes easy when you're traveling at 80 kilometers per hour. You know that definitely you're going to do 1 kilometer a minute. And so if 50 kilometers Puttaparthi is away, then maybe in 50 minutes max you will be home. So this was going on in my mind. What I would like to say is, however young we are, however old we are, that curiosity or inquisitiveness or that eagerness to know how much we have progressed on the journey, how far we are from the goal, and how long we have traveled or how fast we are traveling, all these are things that come up so naturally. So that is the reason why we have taken up today's topic, where this kind of inquisitiveness, curiosity and eagerness arises even in our spiritual journey, when we want to know how far we have traveled, how fast we are traveling, are we traveling at all, are we traveling in the right direction. And this satsang will try to discuss on how we can know that we are spiritually progressing and how do we measure our progress in the spiritual journey.
I think it's something which would interest most people, because you know, what we generally do is when we are not in a spiritual life, let's say you've not started a spiritual journey, you're always wondering, "Oh, where am I in life? You know, how much have I achieved or what I wanted to achieve?" When we come to a spiritual journey, suppose you meet a guru and you start getting initiated into a certain form of spiritual journey, you start wondering, "Am I making that progress here?" we bring that same eagerness and enthusiasm from our worldly goals into our spiritual goals and spiritual journey. And I think all of us do that. And this eagerness, in our own way, we keep measuring ourselves. And I think most of us, what we do is, we measure it in comparison with others, because that's how we do it in worldly life. Right? Always, am I more richer than that person? Am I more successful than so-and-so?
That's what we do in worldly life.
We tend to do the same thing in spiritual life too. But more, something we all have to remember is, in spirituality, the only reference is yourself. And I think that is a good thing to start off with. Remember that all references is only yourself.
Exactly. Perfectly said, Prem. Because, you know, in a worldly sense, there are ways we can define. For example, if you want to define, I'm telling completely in the worldly sense, okay? What do you mean by a successful businessman? So if he is showing profits rather than losses, if he has got more sales and more output compared to his input, if, you know, there are some parameters. If, say, he makes this is the amount of money, this is the amount of influence. So once these parameters are met, you can call him successful in the worldly life. But when we come to the spiritual life, you know, when we look at the past, look at history, at the spiritual masters who have graced the earth, they have been from all fields, they have been from all professions, they have been in all conditions, you know, like people who appear to be cranky, people who appear to be silent all the while, people who do so many different things,
right.
It becomes so difficult to define the characteristics and traits of a spiritual master. I mean, forget so many masters, taking so many masters, when we take Swami himself, if we have to describe Swami to a person who has not seen Swami, how difficult does it become? I mean, you say Swami is love personified, Swami is love walking on 2 feet, and then he asks, does Swami get angry? Yeah, Swami gets angry, but that is also love, you know, because, and so much explanation. Because Swami has shown all the hues of emotions, has shown such a range of feelings, everything. At the same time, he is beyond emotion, beyond feelings. So it becomes so difficult. Therefore, it would, as you said, it would be foolish to compare with anybody else on the spiritual plane, because there is no thing like an ideal way one should lead the physical life when one is spiritually enlightened.
Absolutely, because you're talking about the emotional expressions of the avatar. But even if you look at the physical appearance of the avatar, how different was Swami from Shirdi Baba?
From Rama, from Krishna,
right.
From Jesus.
You know, just, they're not even a few hundred years apart. Right? I mean, if you look at Swami, the way Swami wanted us to dress, the way Swami wanted us to, you know, he insisted that we are all clean shaven. And Shirdi Baba himself had a beard. You know, you cannot go by any of these physical parameters, and I think that's one mistake we have to clearly avoid. Because another thing which Swami would often say is, you know, we know Sage Durvasa was supposed to be a great spiritual master, but he was not somebody who had conquered anger. Or at least he was always known as that angry sage. So even these physical traits is not something to measure by, and that is why it is very difficult to compare yourself with somebody else. You know, you can only know for yourself where you are and how far you are, and you can make mistakes in that. You know, there are people who think that they're very spiritually evolved. In fact, you know, there is a very beautiful incident which happened in one of the moral classes that Swami attended in the university.
Okay.
You know, one of the teachers was saying, I think Swami asked the students, if you have any questions, I'll answer you. So one of the teachers asked a question about people who take Swami lightly, or who think that they don't have anything more to learn. You know, there are people who feel that I understand Swami, I know what Swami wants, I know what Swami likes, I know what is a spiritual life. They kind of keep themselves away from the need to be taught by somebody. So this teacher asked Swami that, Swami, what do we do with such people? No, are they right in thinking like that? Or what should be done for these people? Then Swami gave a discourse, and in that discourse Swami said something, and the translator was translating. Swami said, see, there are three types of people. One, who are awake. Okay, those who are awake, nothing needs to be done for them, they are already awake. Then Swami said, there is a second category of people who are asleep. And those who are awake have to awaken those who are asleep. Okay, it's the role of those who are awake to wake up those who are sleeping. Then Swami said, there's a third category. And as Swami told in Telugu, the translator translated, as the third category is those people who are awake and who are pretending to be asleep. Right, that's a general thing which we usually say, right?
Correct. Yeah, you can't wake up a person who
is pretending to be asleep. So Swami said the third category is those who are awake but are pretending to be asleep. That was a translation. Swami said, no, wrong. And Swami repeated his sentence. And again the translator translated it the same way. He said, those who are asleep, awake and pretending to be asleep. Then Swami told the whole sentence in English himself. Swami said, no. The third category of people are those who are asleep and who think they are awake. Swami said, not even God can help them.
Oh, they're in a dream world of their own.
Really, you know, that is why it is saying we can make the mistake of thinking that we are awake. And I think that's a very, very perilous thing to do. We need to look at ourselves and say, are we really awake? Or how far are we from being awake?
I remember the same thing, reading it somewhere else, put in another way. You know, those, what Swami put as those who are sleeping but they think they are awake.
Mm-hmm.
It is said that those are the kind of people who don't know and don't know that they don't know.
Right.
That is the most dangerous kind of people. They don't know the truth and they don't know that they don't know the truth. Better than that would be those who don't know and know that they don't know. That is where humility comes in and the spiritual journey begins.
Right.
And you know, this discussion has somehow reminded me of one incident. I think we have narrated this in some other satsang, in some other context.
Okay.
But I would like to narrate it again because I think it brings to the fore one important quality to see whether, you know, we are spiritually progressing or not. If we want to measure our progress, this quality definitely comes to the fore. And this is the experience of Professor H.J. Bhagya.
Mm-hmm.
From the Institute of Higher Learning, the Department of Management, the MBA faculty. He's in a faculty in the MBA department in our institute.
Right.
He held various positions across the globe. I remember he worked in Holland and different other European countries. He's a chemical engineer by education and profession. And he had done very well in his career and he was earning a lot. When that point came in his life where he felt, you know, that no progress is worthwhile without spiritual progress, and therefore he decided to give up everything and dedicate his life only for spiritual uplift. And that is what, at that time he had got to know Swami, and that is what brought him to Swami. He landed up in Puttaparthi, and that is when, you know, Swami appoints him as one of his teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bhagya sir starts to teach, and when he starts to teach, he sees, you know, a teacher's job is so tough. For taking a class of 1 hour, you have to prepare for 8 hours. It's just like, you know, for our 1.5 hour satsang, we prepare for almost 8-9 hours. It's just like that, because there are keen ears, keen minds listening, and everybody is participating. So therefore, you need to be so prepared. And therefore, he found that so much of his time is going in preparation for classes, mundane classes, business classes, which he's not at all interested in, which he gave up doing so that he could pursue a spiritual life. So in an interview he got with Swami, he tells Swami, Swami, I came here for spiritual life. I don't want all these worldly things. I don't want this teaching and I don't want any of these. So please don't get me immersed and drowned in that. Save me from that. I have left everything and come for spirituality. So don't put me back into this mundane world, into this worldly stuff. And when he said this to Swami, he said in an instant, Swami's rupa, the form of Swami changed, in the sense, from a smiling, loving being, his eyes became red and bloodshot almost, and there was a kind of divine anger with which Swami said, "Hey Bhagya, if you separate things as worldly and spiritual, even in 1,000 births, I will not give you what you are seeking." And Bhagya sir was saying, "Oh my God," he did not say that you will not get what you are seeking. He said, "I will not give you what you are seeking," which means that this is the authorized signatory for my spiritual progress. He is the person who is going to grant me what I am seeking. And it is after that, you know, he just became quiet and he began to do mananam and nididhyasam, what Swami said, and he continues to be a teacher in the institute today, doing what in quotes we can call as worldly activities. So from this incident, it becomes very clear that one attribute or one quality of a spiritually advanced being, or a way to measure our spiritual progress, is how little we do to discriminate between worldly and spiritual. We should not discriminate or distinguish anything as worldly or spiritual, because everything is spiritual. The ability, how much able we are to see everything as spiritual, shows how progressive we are on our spiritual path.
I think it's a very, very valid and beautiful point that you made, because when we started, we said when we come to a spiritual journey, we bring in our traits from the worldly journey to the spiritual journey. And essentially what you're saying is, it has to come to a point where these spiritual values have to percolate into your worldly life to such an extent that there is no difference. Because you cannot say that I'm going to be a peaceful, calm man when I go only into my meditation class. You cannot say that it's 4 to 8 is meditation hours or spiritual hours and I will be a peaceful, calm person and, you know, loving and compassionate only in those hours. After that, I'm a corporate man and I have to live my life like
mad.
Right, I have to be like a, you know, animal after my goals. It's not like that. You will have to bring in your spiritual understanding to a worldly life. And that's what Swami has said, and many times. I remember Venkatraman Sir saying that when Swami gifted him with a beautiful gold pen.
Okay.
Swami materialized a pen for him, and after many years, Swami one day suddenly asked him, he said, are you using that pen? And he was a vice chancellor then, so he said, Swami, I'm using it for Swami's work. He said, for whatever Swami's work, like signing something which was related to the university, I guess. He said, I use it for that. Swami said, when will you stop differentiating between your work and Swami's work? Swami said, you should do every work as God's work. You have to take everything that you do as doing it for Swami.
Wow, you know, and that is what is expressed when in Swami's aphorism that duty is God,
right.
Work is worship. When your work itself becomes worship, because you are not separating it as work and worship. You are not separating it as worldly and spiritual. You are not separating it as God and duty. This I have to do because it's my work. No, I'm doing this as because this is my prayer. And that is a very, very easy thing to measure, because we see it happening every day. Suppose, you know, I have had this sometimes, you know, not exactly at office, but say we are working on a project as students. When we are working, you suddenly see it's a group of 10 people, but invariably there's this famous 80-20 principle. They say that 20% of the people do 80% of the work, while 80% does only the remaining 20%. It somehow happens, you know, in a group of 10 people. I'm talking of an example where I was part of the 20%. I'm sure there'll be instances where I would have been part of the 80%. But you see that two or three of you are slogging for that. The remaining six or seven are riding on you. I mean, riding on your hard work. And there's no way you can separate them because they're part of the group. You have to carry them along. And they also know that. And you feel that it's almost as if they're exploiting you. As I said, this is a situation where I felt exploited. There might be innumerable instances where I might have exploited this group theory thing. It's just that I don't remember them because I am what I am. Anyway, so in such instances, when you feel that what is the use? You know, there are two reactions to this. One thing is the easier one and the most what we think as the normal one. That is to feel, why should I work? I mean, anyway, the six, seven are not working. It's going to go, so why should I work? The other thing is, even if the other six or seven are doing their thing bad, let me work because, you know, my pride is there at stake. If my group goes down, I also go down. So let me work. Now, these are the two normal reactions, and we consider this as a higher reaction. That is where you say that, let me work for the sake of the group. Let me do it because if the group goes down, then my name also goes down. If they say that this is the worst group, then I am a member of the group, so I am also in the worst category. This seems to be the nobler and the right way, but we realize that the noblest way is, I do it sincerely to please my Swami. It might happen, you know what happens is, if you do it with the second attitude, see the first attitude, you're bound to drown, and you're bound to get the bad name, and you don't have any satisfaction. The second thing what happens is, when you do it, and the group succeeds, you feel a tremendous sense of confidence, but also equally egoistic. They say that, you know, these six fellows didn't do a damn thing. I did everything and we succeeded. The problem with that is, if after doing that also, there is a great chance that the group might fail. When that fails, you are devastated. You lose your faith in hard work. You feel, what is the use? There are 80% who take their life easy. So why should I simply slog? I get nothing in the end. That is where treating duty as God and work as worship helps. Because when I'm doing it as perfectly as I have done in the second case, when I want the group to succeed in spite of them being lazy. But my motivation is not for the group to succeed. My motivation is my Swami should be happy. And therefore, the minute I have done it that way, Swami is antaryami. He's in my heart. He knows it already. So he's already happy. And therefore, the very thing of doing the act in itself brings me such joy and happiness. And I'm happy that Swami is happy. So the final result doesn't matter. And this is a win-win situation, because irrespective of what happens in the result, I am happy, because my happiness lies in doing the thing. It's just like worshipping. When I worship, the joy that I get. So therefore, duty is God, work is worship, is so beautiful, and it is drawn out of this ability not to separate spiritual and worldly, because everything is spiritual.
And the fact that it is not very simple, it is not very simple to do your day-to-day work as an offering to God itself makes it very special. Because I remember, you know, one of the alumni meet when Swami was interacting with the old students who had come back to spend a few days with Swami. Swami gave them a session in the Purnachandra Hall where Swami said, if you have any questions, you can ask me. And one of the students asked, he said, Swami, we've all gone out and we've taken up jobs. You know, we want to do some seva, we want to do some service in the name of Swami, but it's so difficult to find a job, find time. Because, you know, he was saying that those few years when you just get into a job, you are squeezed out.
Juiced out.
And, you know, you have no time, especially if you're a bachelor. Then, you know, the organization believes that you need to be stretched thin and spread thin. And, you know, he said, how do we find time, Swami? We're not able to find time to do Swami's work. And we're not able to do seva. Swami said, do on weekends. You know, on Saturdays and Sundays you are off. You do on weekends. Or if you're not able to find that, do once in 2 weeks. You know, take off one day and you do. And then Swami said, if you're not able to find even that time, do whatever you're doing as seva to me. Whatever work you're doing, work in your job, you know, do your job, do your professions, and do it as your offering to me. So if you look at it, Swami is equating you going out and doing service in the society to doing your work at office and offering it to God as my, you know, offering to God. Swami is equating the two, which means this is as pure and as sacred as going out and serving selflessly.
That is what Swami had told even us Sai Sannidhi members, you know, all the students who are working currently in the ashrams. Before the 85th birthday, we all came together, you were also there, part of that team, and we wanted to do something special for Swami. And when we asked Swami, Swami, what is it that we should do, please give us an opportunity, Swami just said, Mimi panim baga cheyandi, just do your work sincerely. And see, there's a catch also over here. When I am doing, say, my Radio Sai work, what should I do to transcend it to worship is, if I sincerely believe Swami is by my side here sitting and watching, what are the things I would do? I mean, today when I look at my own way of working, in between, you know, I log into Facebook. Would I have logged into Facebook if Swami was by my side? No, maybe no. But see, that is what actually brings me, you know, that is why we are all works in progress. You know, yes, we log into our mail, we have some mails to answer. But there are some mails that we need not answer when I'm working, because they're not work related. But I do answer that. If I'm able to every time be aware that Swami is by my side and I'm doing this for Swami, if Swami had told me it is the work you have to do, and Swami is sitting and waiting for me to report back to him, folding my hands and saying, Swami, the work is done, how would I have done the work? You know, this, I'm again speaking from personal example, experience, because once or twice, we have all got this opportunity of working, you know, directly for Swami. And at that time, you know, what is our enthusiasm level, energy level and commitment level, and how we don't get distracted at all. If I'm able to do like that, every work that I do, then it becomes worship. So that is a catch. It's not as if that, you know, I'm just saying that let us not conveniently decipher this as, you know, Swami has only said, so I need not attend bhajan, I need not go for seva, I need not do anything. Because I'm doing my work, let me do my work. Yes, but when you do your work, this is how Swami is meaning. I mean, and at the end of it, you know, what we would do, whatever we make, the thing is, on the way, suppose it's a thing like making a card. I remember when we make the card and take it to Swami, the card is a piece of art, and therefore, everybody in the world has an opinion about art. So everybody says either it's good or bad, but it doesn't matter at all. Finally, what matters is, did Swami like it? I remember once, the whole hostel building was recreated with thermocol as a card. And everybody was in awe and appreciation of it. But that day Swami did not see the card. And the people who made the card, the boys, they were not at all happy. Because it doesn't matter if the whole world is praising. What matters is, did Swami like it? The same thing would hold true the other way. You just make a card which is maybe shabby in the eyes of the world, but Swami blesses it and you are happy. You don't care if the whole world says that, you know, that was a shabby piece of work. So your happiness lies totally in just pleasing Swami, and it doesn't get affected by the reaction of the world. Now, can we carry this also to the workplace? Because we may say we are doing it for Swami, but when the boss calls and blasts us out of shape, we are so depressed and frustrated, which we should not be had we done it for Swami's joy.
Very true, because I remember once, you know, when we were graduating from our UG, we wanted to give some gifts to all our teachers.
Mm.
So I remember all of my classmates got together and we got some gifts, got it gift wrapped, and we went and gave it to one of the teachers who refused to take it. You know, he said, no, this is not right, I shouldn't take gifts from you, and I don't want to take any gifts. So we were pleading with them to accept these gifts. I said, sir, it's a very small gift and we just wanted to give something when we are graduating. So it was a nicely wrapped gift. So we gave it to him and he refused to take. In fact, he refused to even touch it. Okay. Because he wanted to say that he doesn't encourage this. He really wanted to put that in our heads. So we left it on his table. He said, sir, no, sir, you have to take it. We are going to keep it here. So he said, I won't even, you know, unwrap the gift. So I told him, sir, the gift is meant for you. And it was anyway going to be a showpiece on your table. If you want to keep it with the gift wrap, so you're welcome to. The gift is yours, so it doesn't matter to us how you are going to use the gift.
Mm.
Because we have given it to you and it is yours. You know, now when I think of it, when we say I am doing this as an offering to God, am I able to really say, Swami, this is an offering to you and it is absolutely up to you what you do with it?
Going back to your example, Prem, it means that if you were really sincere in what you said, if the next day the teacher has picked up that gift wrapped thing and thrown it in the dustbin, you should not feel hurt.
Right, exactly. In fact, sir even told us that I will give it to somebody. And we told him, sir, that means you have accepted the gift. I mean, you can do that.
Yeah.
Even if you give it to somebody, it means
or
that you have accepted
it. Or you throw it away also, it means...
Right. You know, that's exactly how we have to do it when we say that I'm doing this for Swami. And when you
Beautiful.
Said that, you know, the boss shouts at you, it doesn't matter. You know, my work is done when the offering is done.
Exactly.
And if you are absolutely sincere, and that actually brings us to the next point, when you do it with the absolute idea that I'm doing it for my self-satisfaction and I'm doing it just for this, it doesn't matter what reaction the others come and give for that particular offering that you have made. And
so
what you do is absolutely self-driven.
Self-directed. Rather than, you know, often it turns out that we become circumstance-driven.
Right.
You know, I might not work hard at all on a project. I've done nothing. Just that project succeeds. We see this happening so many times. When the project succeeds, there is celebration. I wholeheartedly go and participate in the celebration. Okay, now if that project had failed and then there is criticism, I might not have participated in it because of my laziness. But I use that also to my advantage. I say that, you know, all said and done, I was not part of the project, so actually the blame does not lie on me. You know, because we are circumstance driven. If it is success, yes, I associate. If it is failure, I dissociate. I don't mind even putting hard work if I am allowed to dissociate myself when it's a failure. But all this happens when we are circumstance driven, result driven. As you rightly said, the second way to measure our spiritual progress is to see how much we are self driven, based on self satisfaction.
Exactly. And, you know, even going back to the same thing of working in your place, you know, I think most of us will work efficiently under an efficient boss. You know, most of us will work if you're in a team which is very vibrant and working, you know, is really strong. But can we do that, you know, independent of where we are, whom we are working for, and which situation you are? Or in the other ways, let's bring it to our mental calm or mental peace. You know, anybody talking to a very calm person will talk calmly.
Nothing great in that.
There's nothing great in you talking calmly to a person who is very calm. Are you able to keep yourself calm and composed and not, you know, given to short temper when you're talking to somebody who has the capacity to instigate you? And that's when it comes to self-driven, you know, calmness.
That is a very special point for me to ponder about personally, Prem, because, yeah, you really struck somewhere deep. And it is, as Swami says, that the ability of a person to steer the ship is not seen in calm seas, but in stormy seas. So how we react in stormy seas is what shows how spiritually developed we are, because we are not allowing the sea to determine how we are feeling inside, but we see everything outside. The sea becomes what we are within. So if I am calm within, even in stormy seas, I will be able to captain my ship comfortably.
Right. I think that's one more Chinnakatha which Swami used to say about that sage who tries to go and pick up a scorpion which is drowning in the river. And every time he picks it up, the scorpion stings him and he throws it back. Then again he picks it up, the scorpion stings him and he throws it back, and then finally he manages to bring it and put it on shore. And somebody comes and asks him, why are you trying to save the scorpion which is stinging
such
you?
Such a foolish thing.
And he says, see, to sting is the scorpion's nature. It stings even the person who is trying to help it. Okay. And he says, my nature is to be helpful. So I need to help even if the other person does not appreciate the help.
Wow.
And you know, that is what it is. If you are a person who is calm because you need to be calm, and that is a commitment you made to God, you will be calm in all situations in the presence of all sorts of people. Not when in the presence of, you know, when I go to the samiti, I'm a little different person. But when I go to the office where there's a rat race, I'm a different person. Or when I go to the school, or when I go to the college where there are, you know, not buckling to peer pressure, I think is a very good measure of how well you are progressing spiritually.
Now, Prem, all the things that we have discussed, they are wonderful points and they are superb. But the thing is, they are qualitative in nature, you know. I can't measure them actually. Okay, right, I should not separate the worldly and spiritual. I should be able to see the spiritual in everything. But even then, it doesn't give me the measurement as to, yes, of course, in my day-to-day life, I'm trying not to separate. But how am I 40% in it, 50%? How do I measure that? Or in the same way, being self-directed, I can keep increasing my self-direction. Again, this is a qualitative measure. If somebody were to, you know, pinpointedly ask, is there a quantifying, you know, you said that satsang was about how do I measure. Give me a way to quantified way to measure. Well, so dear listeners, here is something that Swami said during a discourse on the 19th of February 1970. This discourse is there in the Sai Speaks, where he says one of the most important ways in which you can measure the spiritual progress of a spiritual aspirant is how silent he or she is. Silence, because Swami says sound is the most powerful. In fact, sound is the most subtle, right? Among the five elements, they say Akasha is the subtlest, and the only attribute it has is sound. Fire, I think the next is Vayu, that is air. Air has sound. Apart from sound, you can also feel air.
Right.
Then fire, you can
see it also.
See it also, yeah. See, hear and feel. Then comes water, you can touch it.
It has a form.
And finally, earth, you can taste it also. So, you know, it gets gross and gross. And the other way it gets subtle, the subtlest, one level of greater subtlety and you become one with the divine. And that is sound. And that is why it is said that the whole creation has come from sound, according to the scriptures, and that sound is the Omkara. Even science calls it the Big Bang. I think they have no idea how
in
the
fact,
sound
you know,
is.
Talking of silence being a very good measure, there's a wonderful story which Swami says, which is documented in the Tapovanam book.
Okay.
You know, there it says that when Rama, Sita and Lakshmana are out in the forest, they're going in search of Panchavati before they go and settle there for the next, you know, 13 years. So there they go and overnight they have a stopover at Sage Bharadwaja's ashram.
Okay.
And you know, going by the tradition, the moment the in Rama, Lakshmana and Sita enter the ashram, Sita is taken away to the women's quarters where the guru's wives and all the other women devotees and disciples are there. So she's taken to that quarter, which is just adjacent to the main hut where Sage Bharadwaja and the other, you know, senior disciples are. So Swami describes the scene where Rama and Lakshmana are sitting with all the other sages around them, and just a curtain is parting that portion where the ladies are sitting with Mother Sita. And everybody is eager to know who is Rama, you know, between the two.
Between the two meaning?
Between Rama and Lakshmana. They don't know who is Rama and who is Lakshmana.
Okay, okay.
So everybody is wondering which is Rama and Lakshmana. And it is believed that there are other people also who have come with Rama, Sita and Lakshmana. You know, it is said that Guha came along with them. So they have no idea which among them is actually Rama. They've heard so much about Rama, but they don't know who it is. So Swami describes...
Those days there were no internet messages and
right,
posts and photos.
Facebook posts. So the ladies start asking Sita, you tell us who your husband is in this. Okay. And Sita being, you know, the most pious and chaste of women, she doesn't look at the men's section and say that third from the right or fourth from the left. And nothing like that. So they start describing each one in that gathering and ask Sita, is it your husband? Is this Lord Rama? So they describe each person and she says no, not that, not that. And they finally come to Lakshmana. Is it that fair one who is, you know, they describe Lakshmana very beautifully. Swami says that, you know, there's so much of sharpness in his vision and there's so much of, you know, straightforwardness even in his presence. That's what Swami says. Then she says no. Then finally they come to Rama and describes, is that the one who is dark-chinned, who's got the complexion of a dark rain cloud? And when they describe Rama, Swami says Sita puts her head down.
In silence.
In silence. And all the ladies realize, okay, that is Rama. And Swami goes on to extrapolate this scene and says, this is what will happen to a sadhaka when he comes face to face with truth.
Become silent.
And this is the whole concept of neti, neti, neti. Till you come face to face with truth and you're faced with silence.
Wow.
He says you'll keep no, no, no. And finally when you come face to face with silence, you will not even say yes because there will be only silence. And this exactly is what when you say, when Swami said that, you know, more silence is a sign of more spiritual progress. Because maybe it's directly related to the final ultimate silence which you will come to when you reach the truth.
Exactly. And on many occasions, you know, Swami himself has, if I can say, utilized silence as a way to do so many things. I remember an incident. This is not actually an isolated incident, because it has, I'm sure every student in his student life or every devotee would have come across this. When the Lord goes silent, see, you were speaking about the sadhaka going silent when he comes face to face with the Lord. But very rare to have the Lord go silent when he comes face to face with the devotee. But Swami would do that. And that is what we used to call as the cold treatment, where Swami stops speaking to somebody.
Right.
And this was one incident when Swami had got upset with all the boys. So he had stopped talking to all the boys and he would come complete his darshan rounds, take people for interview, and the interviews would go on till bhajans. And bhajan, Swami comes and sits and no interaction. And after bhajan, receives aarti and leaves. So there was almost nil interaction. And what was the consequence of this? What was the result of this? The students became so much more eager to know what is it that has upset Swami and what should we do to make him back fine. So sadhana started in the hostel. The extra bhajans were done. You know, continuous namasmarana was going on. I'm sure you also would have had an experience like this sometime, right, when Swami is upset, where the sadhana quotient of the whole hostel goes up.
You'll suddenly find posters coming all over the hostel saying that silence is golden, talk less, study more.
And people maintain silence, and you know, in an instant, as I said, the spiritual quotient of the hostel goes up, and that is exactly what happened. And then, as Swami continues to keep silent for longer and longer and longer, the intensity keeps building more and more, and then it starts percolating from the from the hostel to the institute, from the institute to the roads, wherever, you know, people decide that, you know, no more, we will not have special food in the hostel. Why? What? We can't celebrate. We eat food only for sustaining the body. Celebrations go down. You know, it becomes a very kind of ascetic life in the hostel, and that is what happened. In spite of that, Swami was not relenting. And then, you know, the story of how actually Swami began to speak again so beautifully was narrated by singer brother Ravi Kumar.
Mm-hmm.
He was saying that one day during bhajans, there was this singer V. Kumar. You know, we have narrated many incidents about him. And he started this bhajan, Sai Prema De Shanti De Anand De. So they say that he started, Sai Prema De Shanti De Anand De. So in between the Prema De and Shanti De, there is this gap. Sai Prema De. And in that moment of silence, he said that the whole bhajan all just broke down unashamedly. You know, they did not have any sense of shame or fear or anything. They just broke down because their heart wanted only one thing, Swami. And apparently that affected Swami physically there. It was seen because immediately after that bhajan, Swami got up from the chair. He came towards them, opened up his arms in an embracing manner and said, "Boys, come." And you know, the way Ravi Bhaiya described that scene, 10-20 of the boys, whichever part of Swami they could manage to hold, they just jumped, pounced upon him, and it was such a loving embrace. It was far more loving than an embrace between a father and a son or a mother and a son, because it was an embrace of a devotee and the Lord. And after that, you know, Swami said, "Past is past," and things in an instant changed. And later on, you know, even if you try to analyze why was it that Swami was upset, you'll never be able to get it, because Swami doesn't strike two birds with one stone.
Right.
He blesses 100 boys with one single silence. That's what he had done. The reasons are different, but his silence, whenever he would take it, would always lead to great introspection among the students when the silence is directed towards the students, in the devotees when the silence is directed towards the devotees. It had happened once when Swami would keep cutting off after the lady side, not going to the gent side. The gent side underwent such kind of introspection, and finally after 20 days when Swami went to the gent side, there was such a celebration. So you see, silence is so powerful. And in this, when we start looking at Swami's statement when he says, "If you do not understand my silence, how will you understand my words?" It gives us real new meaning.
Even as you said that, you know, how Swami uses that silence to make not just those who are, just the student community, let's say, introspect. I remember one of the teachers was saying that it was one of those times when extended period Swami was not talking to students. And Swami was, you know, not coming out. Those days he used to spend hours on that portico where students were sitting in. You know, if Swami has to stop talking to students, he should not come out there. Right? It so happened that one particular time, all the students had gathered under that balcony. Swami used to stay in the mandir here. And they said that when Swami comes out during one particular part of the day, Swami would give a balcony darshan. You know, and all the devotees also would be there, and Swami would come on the balcony. So they said that when Swami comes there, we'll all plead to Swami. So there was this group of students who were standing there, who were permitted to stand there, maybe. And when Swami came on the balcony, it was not just the students who were praying and crying, because the whole devotee section also was standing there and crying. Because they realized that when Swami withdraws himself from the students, you know, that their joy, part of their joy also was going with it. And everybody were praying and, you know, pleading with Swami that, "Swami, please, you know, forgive them." You know, that's what Swami can do with that.
It's a kind of enlightened selfishness by the devotees, if you can say.
Right.
Yeah, they were praying for themselves, but it's an enlightened selfishness where your prayer actually benefits everyone.
Absolutely.
So, definitely, one way to judge if you want, a quantitative measure, is definitely to see how much more silent we have become. we will carry on this discussion further, Prem. But I think this will be a right point to take a break and maybe listen to that beautiful bhajan, Sai right. Prem De Shanti De. Because in these times when Swami seems to have become silent for such a long time, we don't know what is that message that we have to learn and how much more intense we should make, do in our sadhana, so that one day each one of us in our hearts can see Him opening up His arms and calling us to embrace us, and so that our prayer of Sai Premade Shantide Anandade gets fructified.
शांति दे आनंद दे साई प्रेम दे
साई प्रेम दे शांति दे आनंद दे साई प्रेम दे
बाबा प्रेम दे शांति दे आनंद दे साई प्रेम दे
बाबा प्रेम दे शांति दे आनंद दे बाबा
बाबा दया के सागर
तुम हो बाबा दया के सागर
तुम हो गुण मंदिर नटनागर
तुम हो गुण मंदिर नटनागर
आदि अनंत है सत्य सनातन सनातन अलक निरंजन साई नारायण
अलक निरंजन साई नारायण
अलक निरंजन साई नारायण चिदानंद प्रभु कृपाणु प्रेम दे शांति दे आनंद दे साई प्रेम दे
साई प्रेम दे शांति दे आनंद दे साई प्रेम दे
बाबा प्रेम दे शांति दे आनंद दे साई प्रेम दे शांति दे आनंद दे साई प्रेम दे
साई प्रेम दे शांति दे आनंद दे साई प्रेम दे
तुम हो बाबा दया के सागर
तुम हो बाबा दया के सागर
तुम हो गुण मंदिर नटनागर सनातन
सत्य सनातन
अलख निरंजन साई नारायण
अलख निरंजन साई नारायण
सच्चिदानंद प्रभु कृपाणु प्रेम दे शांति दे आनंद दे साई प्रेम दे
साई प्रेम दे शांति दे आनंद दे
दे शांति दे आनंद दे साई प्रेम दे
साई प्रेम दे शांति दे आनंद दे साई प्रेम दे
साई प्रेम दे शांति दे आनंद दे साई प्रेम दे.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and as I was listening to the bhajan, I felt that Swami has already granted the first part of the prayer, Premade. Prem is sitting right before me here. And Prem, here's my question to you. You know, we glorified silence so much, and we said how Swami has utilized silence and how beautiful silence is. And though Swami need not keep silent, he kept silent just to show us the power of silence. What about the fate of people like us, Prem, who are poorly, so hopelessly trapped in Radio Sai, where it's our job to keep talking away, talking away, talking away? Is there no hope for us? I mean, if I measure my spiritual progress based on how silent I am, I think it almost comes to zero, because I'm very rarely silent. So what do we do in such cases? There may be speakers amongst us, there may be other such people whose job makes them have to speak. You know, because I'm asking this not only based on what I'm feeling right now, but also based on some of these questions, you know, that have been cropped up before also. I mean, they have been popped up before. So, what do you say for that?
Yeah, I think, thankfully, there are other means of measuring your spiritual progress. But, you know, most importantly, Swami has told it many times, it's not the silence of words alone. It's an inner silence. You know, if Swami says that, yes, this role of your life is over, now stop talking. How much are we in control of ourselves to stop when we are asked to stop? How much are we in control of ourselves that to speak non-stop when we are asked to speak? You know, that ability to not have a choice, that this is how I am, this is my personality, this is how I have to be. I think that is also a very important thing. Because Swami would, if we really believe that we are tape recorders and Swami says play and we play, then we should be absolutely ready to even become noisy when required and we go into absolute mute when we are directed to.
This thing about inner silence is something very profound, because I remember, you know, when we had come as Balvika's children to Prashanthi Nilayam, we had this that for 5 hours every day, we are supposed to keep Maunam. Maunam is absolute silence. And started off with 5 hours. Towards the end of the 10-day trip, we had taken it up almost till 7 hours. Which means, going by the definition that we have given, there is a spiritual progress already. 5 to 7. I mean, it's almost, 40% increase. But, you know, when you mentioned this inner silence, I remembered that when we used to keep this Maunam, there are some things that you have to communicate. For example, lunch would be brought for us to the sheds. We would have lunch in the sheds. This is, I'm speaking something, I think, in 1994 or 95. So this is quite some time back. And when lunch would be brought to shed, we are all supposed to say what we want for lunch. And now I'm keeping Maunam. How do I say that I don't want sambar or I want extra buttermilk? So we write it on pieces of paper and we show them. But then, you know, after that, sometimes what would happen is, you get bored of silence.
And also the person who's serving should be able to read what you write.
Yeah.
You know, if he cannot read English.
That is one thing. The other thing is, you know, between us, two of us, when you get bored, you want to say something and you have to write it down. It's so much tougher, you know, it's so easy to speak 100 words rather than write 100 words. So now you use the least number of words possible and... this is a radio show, so people can't see what I'm doing. But, you know, it would be like when somebody sees and they misunderstand it, you gesticulate wildly with your hands and we think silence is not talking. But I can make my oomph and grunting sounds and all those sounds you make and you gesticulate and then you bang your head and think this fellow is not understanding and you write a few more words. Basically, instead of 100 words, you're trying to convey it in 10 words. When that doesn't work, you try 20 words. When that doesn't work, you try 30 words. But you know, at the end of it, sometimes you feel it was so much simpler if you could have just opened your mouth and said what you wanted and it would be done within 10-15 seconds instead of taking 5 agonizing minutes. that is when we realize the importance of inner silence and inner calm over just keeping the mouth shut.
Like even as you said that, you know, we end up speaking more than... There was this a monastery where the primary sadhana of that monastery was silence.
Okay.
Okay, everybody, every disciple, every master in that monastery was supposed to maintain silence.
Mm.
And every new entrant into that monastery would be given only two instructions. One is, maintain silence in all times. The second one is, speak when you feel that by speaking you can enhance the silence.
Mm.
You know, that's so profound, because if you feel that by speaking and you can finish with that and then there can be silence, speak then. Don't stick on to silence. That's why I said you should have the ability to be silent when it is required to be silent, and to be, you know, talkative when it is required to be talkative.
You know, Swami gives us the four filter test. He says before speaking anything, apply this four filter test, and if it passes it, then only speak. The first is it necessary? That's what is maunam and silence all about. Nothing is necessary, so keep silent. Second thing is it truthful? Don't open your mouth and use sound to convey lies.
Right.
The third thing is it pleasing? It might be truth. It might be truthful. But if it's going to hurt somebody, why speak out the truth? Doesn't mean you speak the lies. Just don't speak at all. And that is what in the scriptures, you know, in the Vedas it is said, Nabruyat Satyam Apriyam. Do not speak an unpleasant truth. Don't speak it at all. And the fourth point, you know, Swami says, will it improve upon the silence? That is, as you said, very important, because is your word more profound, more meaningful, more significant than your silence? And again, going back to that statement of Swami where he says, if you do not understand my silence, how will you understand my word? It is Swami saying, telling us that my silence is pregnant with meaning. It has so much of message to give you. It has so many things to convey to you. If you are not able to understand my silence, how will you understand my words, which are more profound and more significant than my silence? Because if they were not, then I won't speak at all. I'm speaking only because it improves over my silence.
Yes.
So this four filter test is something that we can apply. But again, you know, this comes to physically speaking, our mouth speaking. Now we spoke of an inner silence. What does this inner silence actually mean? Swami says, the Manasa Sarovara, the mind, the lake of the mind, you know, Manasa Sarovara in the Himalayas is said to be the mother source for all the major rivers.
Right.
Anyway, the Swami compares the Manasa Sarovara to the mind. He says it is actually placid and calm. And that is one speciality of Manasa Sarovara. If you go to Manasa Sarovara, they say you can look at the, you can look 100 meters deep into the lake at the bottom, because the waters are so still, placid and calm. Swami says that's how the waters of the mind are. Now imagine you drop a pebble into it. Ripples get created and there's disturbance. And Swami says that pebble is thought. So, the stillness of the mind, the silence of the mind, the inner silence that we speak about gets disturbed by thoughts. And naturally the number of thoughts, more the number of pebbles and rocks you throw into the lake, the more are the ripples. So therefore, I think inner silence means silencing of one's thoughts.
Very true. In fact, you know, that also brings to another point where it leads to a sense of lesser restlessness. You know, when you're talking about quantifying your progress, you know, your ability to be occupied with things outside you, the need, not the ability, the need to keep yourself occupied from things outside you, people outside you, with company from outside, that will drastically reduce. Because, you know, if you look at it, I mean, we all are actually going through that phase of restlessness where, you know, I'm having my mobile in my hand. If I'm done with my mobile, I need another gadget to keep myself occupied. I'm looking at the TV, I switch off the TV, I need something else to do. Because we are only, our boredom is increased, our restlessness is increased. Your ability to be in solitude, if you are given one full day without any of these gadgets, you will be allowed to stay in a room all by yourself, you will enjoy that solitude.
That is what happens. You know, recently I had been to the Himalayas. The Himalayas do that to you. Partially it is done forcefully. The other thing, it is done with its beauty and spiritual mysticism. The forceful part is there is no network there. It is cut off from all your devices. There is nothing you can do. Just sit in nature. So the forced part of it comes. And once you obey the forced part of it and somehow sit there, then the other part also starts coming in. And the other part starts coming in because, you know, Prem, one of the members who had come along with us on the trip, he was saying that I've often seen and experienced the expansiveness of the sky, the expansiveness of the ocean. The Himalayas taught me the expansiveness of the mountains. You know, that sight is so, what can I say, daunting, awe-inspiring, hitting, magnificent. When you look at those mountains, I mean, I have seen snow-capped mountains once before on the previous Himalayan trip and it was the same experience. And this, so therefore this is not something like, because it's the first time it's feeling like that. First time you may feel it even more, but every time you look at it, it's so marvelous. You almost become thoughtless, you know, all your thoughts are looking at that mountain. That the beauty is so grand that it hits you. Now imagine, this is the beauty of creation. When you are actually witnessing the beauty of the Creator, you naturally become so silent within. And you know, that is meditation. That is what they do in meditation. What do we do in meditation? They tell us to, you know, focus on a jyoti in jyoti meditation. They tell us to focus on the form of the Lord. They tell us to focus on light. And there's the Hamsa Gayatri meditation where you focus on your breath. Basically, what they're doing, what meditation teaches us to do is to begin with, that's what Swami says, the first stage is concentration. Mm-hmm. We start concentrating on a single thought or a single idea or a single object. Recently, I remember Dr. Srikant Solab, an amazing person and definitely I feel spiritually evolved, when he was teaching the thumb meditation. There have been people who have been benefited greatly by meditating on their thumb. You know, which shows that it doesn't actually matter what you meditate on, whether your breath, your thumb, a lamp, a photograph of Bhagwan. All you need to do is focus on one thing.
In fact, he says that, you know, thumb meditation, because thumb is something you can carry it everywhere.
Yeah.
That's what he says.
Yeah, maybe you can't light a candle in the Himalayas, whether it's breezy.
Says, why thumb? Because thumb is something which you carry it always. So you can meditate anywhere.
Going by that logic, maybe Prem, if you're going to the Himalayas, you can definitely do Swami's form meditation also. Because trust me, you know, every place you go, there are Swami's photographs. It's so amazing. It's Daiva Bhumi. Everybody, you know, without exception, seems to know about Swami. It's so amazing, and that is not the case in Anantapur, which is just 80 kilometers from here. But it's amazing. Well, that's an aside. But coming back to this, so basically you're cutting off all your thoughts and keeping only one thought. So from a state of 1,000 thoughts, which is an underestimation, because I think currently I'm having 1,000,000 thoughts now. Coming from a state of 1,000,000 thoughts to one thought is such a huge quantum leap in silence, which makes you get in touch with divinity, because it's only in the depths of silence that you hear the voice of God. It takes you closer to God. And that is why I think we are told to meditate, so that we are able to still the mind, the waters of the Manasa Sarovara.
Very true. And I think that is what the ability to go into that peace. You know, I am reminded of what most spiritual masters used to say. Are you able to see that silence which is underlying all this noise? It is not silence when there is silence. Are you able to listen to that silence when you're in the middle of the marketplace? Are you able to hear that silence?
I laugh because I remember recently, I think I told it in the satsang also, that I got inspired that I should do some meditation. And when I started the meditation, the thing was, I sit for meditation, suddenly I become so aware of all the sensations of my body, and I'm telling this in a negative way. The tip of my nose is itching. I see a bead of sweat dropping down my forehead. So what do I do? And suddenly at that, exactly that moment, you know, there's a donkey that's tied near our house. It starts braying.
Okay.
I get so irritated on that donkey. You know, when I'm actually doing something else, the donkey might be braying so many times through the day, I don't notice it. But now that I'm in meditation, with this awareness comes also this disturbance. And then in order to shut the donkey out, I go and shut the window and curtain the window there. Still filters through, but this is manageable now. But now the room starts getting hot. And as I said, the sweat comes and disturbs me. So I go and put on the fan. The fan starts turning, and now as I'm meditating on the lamp, you know, it extinguishes the flame, which is the object of my meditation there. And I said, oh my God, now what do I do? So I need a glass thing to put around and protect the flame. See, so many, as you said, meditation is not about silencing when it's absolutely silent and beautiful. It is good. In the beginning, it is good. You know, it's like the support wheels when you ride a bicycle. So it's good that you start off in the Himalayas. But it's not that every time you have to meditate, you have to go to the Himalayas. Every time you need to meditate, can you get the Himalayas within you? That is what it is. That is what Swami would say. It's not as if every time you have a trouble, you come to Prashanti. That is good. It's like a repair shop. But you should be able to carry Prashanti in your heart. So, yeah, coming back to the practical implications of inner silence. Okay, again, now, you know, when we speak of the outward silence, it's something that I can measure. Whether I'm speaking for 5 hours a day or whether I'm speaking for 10 hours a day. The minute you take it to inner silence, now again you have taken it to a qualitative thing. How do I measure inner silence? For this, you know, I think there are some things you can measure which actually show the degree of inner silence that you have. Mm-hmm. It may not be a direct measurement of the inner silence, but some things which definitely are a measure of the degree of inner silence. And one of them is equanimity. See, for example, I get angry in a situation. Again, I'm speaking from personal experience. I get angry, and if I'm having an inner silence where I have only one thought or no thoughts, and if it's one thought, of course, I will consider it as a thought on Swami, but it can be just one thought. Absolute thoughtlessness, no other distracting thoughts, so I'm peaceful, and suddenly a second thought comes in where, you know, I'm irritated with a person there. And I start arguing with him, or I start fighting with him, I abuse him, he abuses me, all this happens. One way is, if I'm in inner silence, this should not happen, right? So, if it used to happen 20 times a day, and today it happens only 10 times a day, yes, that's a way to quantitatively measure the progress. Okay, so that is one thing. The number of times, the frequency with which I lose my equanimity. And losing equanimity need not mean only frustration, depression and anger. When I get excited and thrilled, that is also losing equanimity. I'm thrilled and I go overboard. They say don't make a promise when you are happy, when you hear good news, because right, you will overpromise. So that is also a shift from anything that's a shift from equilibrium. How many times I shift from that equilibrium? That is one way. The other thing is, say if I used to get angry once a day 10 years ago. And even today I'm getting angry once a day. Then what? Then what we can do is, now when I get angry, it upsets me, my mood gets spoiled, I don't feel like eating, I don't feel like talking to anybody, and that ugly mood lasts for 2 hours. If today, that same ugly mood lasts just for 10 minutes, that is definitely another way to measure. One is the frequency of the attacks, another is the intensity of the attacks. What if I get angry, but within a minute I'm able to calm down? That is definitely spiritual progress. So, coming down to practical indicators, I think frequency of attacks which take you away from equilibrium and intensity of attacks which take you away from equilibrium are two ways by which definitely we can measure our spiritual growth.
In fact, I'm reminded of one thing which someone had told, how to control anger.
Mm.
And this again is a very direct way of, you will be able to measure, you know, how well you are in control of yourself and how well you are progressing. Because he said, if you see the sequence when what happens when you get angry, is that an event happens, and anger is a very spontaneous reaction. I mean, it doesn't come out of thinking; it comes out as a reflex. Right? It's instinctive to get angry. And if you are a person given to short temper, it's instinctively comes. It doesn't, you know, take your permission and come out. So there's an event. There is an anger. And after that, slowly the anger fades away. You know, even the most angry person does have this, you know, calm down eventually. And after the anger goes, comes the period where you think. Where you ask yourself, you know, what really happened? Was it really, does it really warrant that kind of temper? And, you know, who was wrong? Was I wrong or was the other person wrong? The thinking process comes. And this person was telling, when you talk of controlling anger, how quickly does that thinking process comes? That's one thing. How quickly are you able to subside from this angry emotion, and the thinking process comes? And he said, with time, you will have to delay this anger response. When an event happens, are you able to delay this anger response and bring the thinking between the anger response and the event which has made you angry.
And if you're able to do it successfully, right, that means theoretically a point will be reached when there'll be no anger response
right
at all.
Because initially what will happen is the event will happen, then you will start forcefully thinking and still there'll be an outburst. And it's not like the anger doesn't happen. But the more and more you distance the event and the anger from, you will have enough time to reason out and the anger will go away. And this ability to think when the situation is wrong, I feel that also itself is a very good measure of how well you're progressing. The ability to think clearly with clarity when you are in a difficult situation.
And you know, extrapolating this, it goes on further too. Because it is not, as I said, just about negative situations, even positive. You know, somebody comes and pats you on the back and says, you have done a great job. This was fantastic. Really enjoyed. Your satsang was superb. You know, it changed my life. Oh, wow, I'm over the moon. You know, this is again a shift from equilibrium. It's an instantaneous reaction, a spontaneous reaction, where, you know, somebody had very humorously said that a pat on the back often leads to a swelling in the head. apparently not connected, but definitely connected. So, this also, that thinking process, if we can bring in, you know, if I can tell Arvind, 100 times in the satsang, you have mentioned that it is not you. That you have yourself seen how ideas arise spontaneously in your head. And you know that these ideas are not yours, these are being planted. And they are being planted just because you have been given the opportunity in front of the mic. Had somebody else got the opportunity, it would have been planted in them. So, be grateful to Swami and be humble, because nothing is yours. You know, you are nothing and you have seen how you have floundered when that spark of divinity doesn't descend. So, be grateful to that divinity and be humble, know that you are nothing. Now, this thinking process, if I can bring in between the pat on my back and the swelling in my head,
right,
I don't think that I will ever suffer with swelling in my head. In the sense, I will never suffer from pride, ego, conceit and vanity. So, this is not only for the negative situations, it's even for situations which are positive.
Very true.
Praise and blame. I'm saying this because, as is the practice, Prem, you know, I just threw out this question open on, you know, and possibly when on some social forum, just throw it open and ask people, what do you think? Many people have come up with this answer, saying that, you know, if you are spiritually progressing, you should be able to take praise and blame with equanimity. You should not let either affect you. And we see that this equanimity comes from inner silence, because equanimity is a state of absence of thoughts. When you don't have thoughts, you have no like, no dislike. So it's not just the absence of irritation, frustration and dislike. It is also the absence of wanting, craving, liking, desiring, you know, all that things also. So equanimity is a beautiful state, and I think this is definitely measurable, as we
very
said,
true,
in three ways. One is how much time it takes for us to do this introspection. Second thing is, how frequent are we subjected to this attack? If from 10 times a day, if I can come down to 4 times a day, it's achievement, it's a progress. And how intense that is. If it lasts, sometimes, you know, it lasts 2 weeks, it lasts a month, it lasts 2-3 days.
I think that's a very important point which you said. You know, many times, this is again from personal experience, what we understand is, you're angry or you're very upset or very, something has really troubled you, and you make a decision then. Then you can imagine how much effort goes into holding on to the decision which was made in a wrong moment. You know, when you're angry, when you're excited, as you said, happy or elated or depressed, that's the worst moment to make a decision. And how many of us make decisions in that moment and rest of our life try to hold on to that decision? You know, at that moment we say that I will not talk to this person. You know, I will not take any help from this person or whatever. And how much effort we put in after that to hold on to that promise which we made in a wrong moment.
Correct.
When we were in a moment where we were most vulnerable to make a wrong decision.
Most illogical.
Right.
And most emotional.
And then we try to hold on to it when we are even sane after that. You know, that is again, I think what you could say is probably detachment from the decisions which you make in the wrong moments.
Exactly. So that is why it is said, don't take a decision when you're angry.
Right.
As a follow through to that, maybe we can now say that if we are really spiritually progressing, even if we take such a decision, we will have the ability and humility to accept the foolishness of that decision and reverse the decision if necessary when we return to our sane thoughts.
In fact, you know, many times that was something which would really strike me as very different when Swami would do that.
Hmm.
You know, Swami would show so much anger, but Swami would know when to stop that anger because he was really showing it. He was not, Swami was not angry, Swami was showing anger. And that's the difference. Because Swami would know, okay, now the anger has outlived its relevance, and Swami would stop there and then turn to what was needed for the next moment.
Wow. You know, that brings another, indicator, way to measure spiritual progress, where you are able to use emotions as tools.
Right, absolutely.
That's all, without getting personally affected. You know, as you said, anger is something in Swami.
That's what a mother does every day, right?
Hmm.
You know, when she refuses something to the child, or she says, no, you deserve to stand in the corner.
Hey, go and stand there. Huh?
Right. You know, mother does it every time. The next moment, she forgets it.
It is used as a tool.
Right, it's used as a tool.
But what happens is we get so involved, and in fact, today, if I'm angry on you, and then I walk away in a huff, tomorrow when I meet you again face to face, every single thing that I felt the previous day starts returning back.
Right.
I'm holding on to it and carrying it. Which means, it reminds me that story of the two monks crossing the river.
Right.
And one of the monks helps a lady by carrying her on his shoulders, and the other monk, after reaching the monastery, says, Master, you know, this guy, we are not supposed to go near women. He carried a woman. And then the master says that he dropped the woman on the other side of the riverbank. He carried her into the monastery. So, it is, again, this the difference between the external and the internal. It's about being in the internal silence, being in that internal state of equanimity. You know, this is just off the cuff. I'm reminded of another story, you know, Chinnakatha, okay, which Swami says. I think, was it Ubhaya Bharati? Not Ubhaya Bharati, forget it. He says that there is this couple who have decided to take up spirituality as their goal in life. And when they are walking, the man sees a golden bangle on the road. And he feels that, you know, now we have taken up a spiritual way of life, but when my wife sees that, her old tendencies might erupt and she may want to possess that gold bangle. So let me do something so that situation doesn't arise. So he takes some mud and he covers up that gold bangle with his feet. At the same time, Swami says the wife is thinking, how foolish of the man. He is still distinguishing between dust and gold when everything is the same. So, you know, this story again shows it is not about external control, about external show. It's about how you are within. The woman had no difference. She saw the mud with the same interest with which she saw the gold, or vice versa. So it is an inner silence or equanimity that is more important than the external silence, though external silence is the first step, because keeping the mouth shut, they say, even a fish will not get into trouble if it keeps its mouth shut. So keeping the mouth shut is the first way to avoid all problems, but it does not end
there,
with that.
Right? You know, even as you were saying that earlier, you were making the point of that inner silence and equanimity, when happy or sad, you know, that's a very important thing. Even as you were saying that, I was reminded of a beautiful story I read somewhere. There was this Sufi saint who was known in that village for somebody who had reached a very high state of understanding. One day a villager runs into his house and he says, Master, your son is drowning in the river.
Hmm.
Okay, and I think we have lost him. He's drowned in the river. The Sufi saint is sitting wherever he's sitting. He looks up into empty space, you know, looks up, and then he just smiles to himself. And this guy thinks, what's weird? And just then another villager comes running and he says, Master, your son has been saved. Somebody jumped into the river and brought him out. And again this man looks up into empty space and smiles to himself. So now the first villager who came in is very surprised. He said, Master, I can understand you smiling when your son was saved, but why did you smile when I came and told you that your son is drowning? So then the Sufi master explains. He says, when you came and told me that my son is drowning, I searched within myself. Is there a feeling of despondency and despair? He says, I didn't find it, so I was happy. And when the second villager came and told that my son was saved, I looked inside myself to see, was there a feeling of elation? He says, I didn't find it, so I was happy.
You know, Prem, this is so magnificent because it clears one wrong notion that we entertain in our head, which is when we say equanimity, we think it is some kind of a boring, dull, and you know, a very sad-faced kind of thing.
Right.
You know, it is such a dull, there's no emotion and stuff. You know, it's, we take it in a negative sense. But that silence, that equanimity, if you want to experience that, go and have a look at Manasarovar. I mean, Manasarovar doesn't have any, ups and downs. There are no waves that come. It's so still. Do you find that stillness boring? That stillness and the silence is so vibrant. It is so beautiful. As you said, both times he was happy.
Happy, right.
It's about not being sad and not getting excited. Not going to the extremes. But this equanimity, the state of equanimity that we state is blissful. It is blissful. And, you know, did I narrate this difference between happiness and bliss?
Even if you have, you can.
Yeah, because I think maybe with that we can conclude. Dear listeners, we have several more points, but this is so beautiful because, you know, the warden of our Vrindavan hostel, Ravi Kumar, T. Mm-hmm. Ravi Kumar, mm-hmm. he was narrating this during the Himalayan trip.
Okay.
One Swami called him into the interview room, and when he was studying at Anantapur, mm-hmm. not the college here,
right,
but there was a
separate
college.
He was doing his master's in SP University. Yeah.
So when he was doing that, Swami called him into the interview room and there was a VIP guest there, he says. And Swami asked him, why did you come here? Ravi Kumar said, did not know what to say. He said, Swami, I came here for darshan. That's the truth. Swami said, why you want to have darshan? Swami, because it fills me with bliss. So when he asked, when Swami said that, Swami said, are you sure it is bliss? It is not happiness? He said, no Swami, it is bliss. What is the difference between happiness and bliss? Ravi Kumar sir confessed that, you know, just like what happens during our satsang, it is definitely not our brains or not our minds that is answering. It is Swami only prompting the answer just as he is prompting the question. And he said that Swami wanted to say, see, our boys are so good. So he says, without his knowledge, the answer came. He said, Swami, happiness is temporary because, see Swami, if I eat a gulab jamun today, I feel so happy. 10 years from now, when I'm feeling hungry, if I think of that gulab jamun, it doesn't satisfy my hunger. It doesn't give me joy. In fact, it makes me feel a lack and makes me feel even more painful. When you're, if a hungry man is just imagining a gulab jamun, right. It makes him feel more miserable. He said, but on the other hand, Swami, when I have your darshan, I'm feeling so happy now. 10 years from now, if I'm not physically there in your presence, when I think of this darshan, it still gives me happiness. It increases my happiness. And when I share the story of this darshan with others, it gives them also the happiness, though they have not experienced this at all. That is why, Swami, this is bliss. It is permanent. So, I mean, it is so beautiful. That is why in a state of equanimity, you are blissful. Because yours is a permanent kind of happiness. And later on, you know, in the same trip, I was speaking to Brother Sanjay Mahalingam. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that once he asked Swami, Swami, what is the difference between happiness and bliss? Now, this was the answer that Swami prompted through Ravi Kumar sir. But here is the Swami answer that Swami directly gave. He said to Sanjay Mahalingam, causeless happiness is bliss. If you find a reason why you are happy, then that is not bliss. I'm happy because I ate this. I'm happy because I won this. I'm happy because my mother is coming. I'm happy because of my son is saved in the case of that Sufi master.
Right.
Then that is not bliss. I'm happy because there's no because. I'm just happy. That causeless happiness is bliss. That is what Swami had told him. And that is possibly a nice point where we can conclude this partial discussion.
Yeah, I think we've not completed it. There are so many more points, but maybe quickly to tell that what we covered. To start with, the most important thing, that the distinction between your life or your worldly life and your spiritual life will start being lost and being dissolved. Mm-hmm. That's a very important thing to start with. The second thing we spoke about was where you are self-driven. Whatever you are, you are, wherever you are and whosoever company you are in. If you're a calm, peaceful person, or if you're trying to be a calm, peaceful person, you will be like that in whichever place you are put in. It's not dependent on the situation around you. So you are self-driven, right? And then of course we spoke about silence, the importance of silence. External silence and internal silence, and most importantly internal silence, which leads to equanimity and a state of equilibrium. And how easily we are able to get back to that equilibrium every time it's disturbed. How violent is that deviation from that equanimity, and how fast we are able to get back.
So that is quite a lot of theoretical tips and practical tips. Dear listeners, we are sure that you have so much to contribute, and we would love to share in your experiences and your insights, because definitely this is a topic that we will be spilling over to the next week. So the Ramakatha Rasavahini fortnight gets postponed by a week, and this we will continue to discuss on how do we measure our spiritual progress. All your suggestions, all your experiences are most welcome. You can write into listener@radiosai.org. For those of you who are on Facebook, you can definitely like the Radio Sai page, and this topic will be created as a special event in the coming week on the Radio Sai Facebook page. You can even contribute your comments, thoughts and ideas over there. And we will definitely, like this week, we have used the thoughts and ideas from people whose feedback we could already receive. We will definitely be using all your thoughts, your ideas, your experiences in the coming Thursday satsang. So all of you are welcome to share in the satsang and make it more fruitful, more meaningful, and hope you enjoyed this satsang as much as we enjoyed it here.
So dear listeners, on behalf of all of you and on behalf of both of us here, we offer this segment at Swami's Lotus Feet. We leave you with a song. Brother Chandu is not here with us today, so we're going to play a earlier Love to Love segment for you. So we hope to listen from you what your thoughts are on this satsang. Thank you for being with us. Jai Sai Ram.
को भाई जगती माया प्रभु को कभी न ध्याया मन को भाई जगती माया प्रभु को कभी न ध्याया हर पग में मेरा मन भरमाया सत मार्ग ना पाया सुंदर जीवन पाकर भी मन मूर्ख समझ न पाया माया के झंझाल जगत में माया के झंझाल जगत में घेरे अंतर ज्योत जला दे ले ले नाम हरि का अब तू अंतर ज्योत जगा ले पाकर सार प्रेम का मन ये आनंद में हो जाए जलांतर में पालो शाश्वत धाम बोलो राम साईं